for coffee, but I want to give you a chance if you have any questions for anyone here from anything you've heard this morning. And, Stu, I should say that I think in the past year or so it's become slightly less unnerving to hear an American use military analogies. So if it occurs to you during the question and answer. Okay. Can you identify yourself first and then...
My name is Peter Bourne from Oxford University. I have known Muhammad Yunus for about 30 years. I'm an extraordinary admirer of what he's done and the impact that he's had. I'm delighted that you're doing what you're doing in New York City, but you see a handful of poor black women being helped. A few blocks away, a corporate executive is going home with a $10 million or $50 million bonus, vastly more than you are putting out there in your entire program. I think one of the risks we run is that we confuse assuaging our own sense of guilt with coming to grips with what is the real problem. And the real problem, as I think we all know, is that it is the income discrepancy between the rich and the poor in different countries that is the root problem that we're facing. I think many corporate executives are very, very sincere, or some corporate executives are very sincere in wanting to use their wealth and ability to do good in the world, to help people, particularly in developing countries. I think, though, for many, it's just a public relations strategy. They want to enhance their image by saying we're doing something that benefits the general welfare. And I think Stuart Hart really focused on that. What I would like to ask is how you think that corporations could get out the message that Dr. Marmot presented last night. How can you get the world to understand that the root cause is this income discrepancy? We know that the greater the income discrepancy, the more the bad health, the more the social problems, and that there is a gradient, and you reduce the discrepancy between the rich and poor, and that will deal with the health problems. Would like to address my question to Mr. Mittal. What would Microsoft do to make sure that there are tens of millions of people in the world who really understand the message that Dr. Marmot is trying to get out there?
Well, that's an interesting question. And, of course, certainly in the last year, this has become something that we all are increasingly aware of and interested in. And certainly on a personal basis, many people are perturbed by as well. It's not clear to me that, from a corporate perspective, this is something that, as a company, we'd necessarily be focused on highlighting income disparity. Okay? Instead, instead, I think our approach is more about saying, how can we ensure that the results of these income disparities, which is a differentiated access to information and experiences, how can we reduce that? Right? Because it's not about the income disparity itself. It's the fact that if you have a lot less money, you can't get the same experience or the same resources or the same data. It's actually fundamentally increasingly more about access to information. And if we can reduce that part by making sure that people, no matter where they're in the pyramid they reside, they have access to the right information and the right technology and the right education and the right data, okay, so that they're on a level playing field, that becomes very, very interesting. Okay, and we actually believe fundamentally that the power of technology has that ability in a scalable way, in a cost-effective way, of addressing issues like that.
Okay, thanks. We have another... question there. Does anybody else want? Kevin, do you want to
I think the answer is to empower the people to talk on behalf of themselves. We are amazed at the confidence that these people start showing in themselves. And rather than the corporations talking about the issue, I think it's so important to have these people who have had their lives changed become the spokespeople. And I think it's important for companies such as Emits and companies such as us to use them as our spokespeople. We just changed that film, by the way. I said to my media people, we don't have interviews with our socios on there. So our latest iteration that came a little late last night is, you know, we have to have them talking about their issue. We have to create them as our spokespeople.
Okay.
Thank you. Tremendously impressive 8 o'clock lecture and presentations. My question is regarding the rich and the poor. Your bank, Stephen, and this question is directed to you, please, and anybody else that wishes to answer it, began in Bangladesh, began because of the need to lend to people who wanted a little startup capital, and it's been tremendously successful. You're now in the first world with your introduction to the Americas, and you'll expand, as you say, into Canada. My question is, with the failure of the traditional banking systems, which has ruptured the world's economy, mainly because of the greed on the inappropriate lending and the impossibility of people to pay back when things got rough, and we're still coming out of that recession, how can a bank like yours, which learnt its craft in an area where you would never normally get a Western bank lending money, coming into the West and teaching other banks how to, in fact, fund the poor to kickstart their future lives and their future investments?
It's an interesting question, but we do not take on the role of trying to teach the other banks anything. We are focusing on our borrowers, and we are trying to help them. Our conversations with the banks in New York is what we are providing they can never do. Everything that they do, we do the opposite. If they ask for assets, we want to prove that our borrowers don't have any assets. If they want to have long documents, we want to have a very simple document. There is not one ingredient that a New York City bank does that we do. We're not a bank also. We use the banks right now. We put our deposits in the banks. They are insured. They provide a service. They provide a service at lower cost than we could ever do by ourselves. So what do we want the banks to do? We want them to recognize that there are poor people. We want them to recognize that they cannot provide the service that they're doing. And there is an incentive in the United States that the banks get a credit, and they have a responsibility to reinvest in their communities. And our focus is getting them to give us loans or donations or grants so that we can continue to provide our service. We get tremendous support from the banks, and it's growing every year.
Just a brief commentary in terms of the fact that the response that you give, Stephen, I think is very relevant in the sense that we may all want to change the world all in a piece and say everything has to be correct tomorrow morning, but we may all look at the way in which we can do the next step. And I think that to the first question, how to change Michael's slides, I think that it is a mixture of policy, it is a mixture of what consumers do, it's a mixture of what company does, and so on. And I think this whole of society is very much what at the platform we want to promote as much as possible. The second point regarding corporation, I think it's true regarding corporation, regarding government or whatever, it is understanding how to change some of the incentive structure. We were in Berlin a couple of weeks ago at a meeting of the Global Partner, And I was talking to the COO of Danone, who was the one who had started this social business that Hans was talking about. And what Emmanuel was saying is that in his company, what has been very, very interesting is the viral, the contagious effects that this initiative has been having, to the point that last year the board decided that the bonus to all level to the hierarchy will not be 100% economic performance, but will be one-third economics, let's start by this one, one-third economic, one-third environment, and one-third social. So I think that there are many ways, if we want to scale up, what can be done for the social determinant, and to say there's no black nor white, there is kind of moving in all its respective way in terms of understanding how the system works, how to change it, and I think it is important to be one piece at a time and close to what we do in life.
Okay, thanks, Larry. I just have I liked your analogy of Dr. Yunus fishing in Moscow and you fishing here in Canada, and the great blue sea that you're looking out on. Can you talk a little bit about how applicable what the Grameen Bank is doing is to other corporations? Maybe, Stu, you want to jump in too. Are we talking about the formulation of a whole new kind of business group where old corporations will operate the way they have been operating and new entrepreneurs will come in? Or are we talking about some of those older corporations starting to sail?
Yeah. Maybe from it's a beautiful point, because I was 14 years in the business of taking care about corporate leadership and corporate culture on the biggest company in my country, in Germany. And step into the social business. It's the same business what you're doing, but it's thinking not, and I'm a serial entrepreneur as well, so setting up 9 businesses in my life and setting up now 9 joint ventures, who is not for me, it's for you. But it's the same passion, it's the same power, it's the same stuff. Just the mindset changed around. And what we observe in the BASF, or what we observe at Danone, what we observe in Adidas, in every group, there is sometimes 4,000 times more clicks on the intranet on the social business aspect than on the charity aspect. And another big thing is what I saw in Stuart, and I study his work a lot, but when we see the pyramid, and we keep on going to see the pyramid device in 800 million, in 1.5, and in 4.5, only in dollars. This is, I think, what we have to make the biggest change, because we have to see how happy, how healthy, and how joyful these people are. We are living on this planet, and coming on the social business aspect means to remind questions to you about how much money I make or how much happiness I have. This is exactly what we have to do. So maybe it will be beautiful with Stuart to see this pyramid from these 800 million people, how much of them are healthy and happy and joyful, and how much are from the others. So maybe we should have one pyramid on a scale it in dollars, and someone scale it in HHG, so happiness, health, what's the most important and joyful. So this thinking starts, the mindset of the people starts. And a last comment, because I have this discussion a lot about how much money makes who. A Japanese guy shows us the slice, then the time, then the difference between the lowest income and the highest income in Japanese country is 1 to 10. In America, it's 1 to 1,500. We have to ask all, and this is to Kevin, we have, I guess, all in the business, we have to ask the question, what is enough? What is enough? Do we need more business to bring more capital on the capitalistic side, or do we have to start business to bring more? And I really like your speech yesterday night, taking the social justice really serious. It was a deep ending yesterday. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
You know, I'm going to use a business analogy, and then I'll get to the point. When we started Sobe became the fastest growing beverage company in the history of the United States. We grew it from zero to 300 million in about 3 years. Okay, and all three of us who founded it were above the age of 50. And we said to ourselves, do we really want to go through — consumer product companies have to reinvent themselves about every 3 or 4 years, particularly if they're in a niche category like beverages, candy, what have you. particularly beverages and fashion. What I think is the answer to your question, to get to that point, is there is a business analogy. And the business analogy is that large corporations have to start reinventing themselves. Early stage SME companies like us, small companies like the Water Initiative, are inventing ourselves, and therefore we're going into the winds of change that Stu is talking about in Capitalism at a Crossroad. But the larger corporations have to reinvent themselves to fit with the times and with what's happening out there. So it's not a matter of, you know, who is going to be the winner. It's going to be those of each category that understand what the trends are and go right into those trends. I like to use an expression, you don't build a successful business, forgive me, by catching the wave. It's too late. You catch the current. You make the change yourself. And the corporations that we talked about last night, et cetera, that are reinventing themselves will be the successful ones in the 21st century.
Thanks, Kevin and Hans. We've got time for two questions, and then we'll have some coffee. So we'll take this question and then that one. So, yeah. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I guess my perspective would be that on the issue of communicating the importance of this to the world, enormously important. You know, and there are a number of different actors who can participate in that, including, you know, the NGO and university sector and government sector above and beyond the companies. But by my way of thinking, and I think it's what these guys are saying, I think it's what all of us are saying, the most important thing we can do is actually generate alternative ways of trying to make this happen on the ground, right? That, unless or until we have viable alternatives that actually work, we don't have anything, right? That, I mean, it's one thing to point out growing inequity and have everyone understand that that exists and the problems that that creates. It's another thing to know what to do about it, right? So it seems to me that the crucial thing that all of us ought to be focused on are the on-the-ground, you know, how do we actually make a difference? And I'm utterly convinced, and I think all of us here would agree, the best way to actually have an impact is to do something that generates a sustainable livelihood, that it's an enterprise-based model that involves people on the ground in participating in their own betterment and empowers them to do so, and is in their own self-interest, is profitable for them, and will therefore replicate itself and will grow. And I think increasingly that's what we see is the best possible approach to try to get after this problem of inequity. And I think what we're all grappling with is what's the best way to go about doing that? I mean, how do we frame that most effectively? And I would completely agree with you that money is just one dimension. I mean, the whole income pyramid thing is a superficial, you know, one-dimensional way of representing it. And the only reason I use it is because that's what people transact on, right? And yeah. And poverty clearly is a multidimensional construct. Money's only one, you know, one, probably maybe the least important aspect of it, because we all know you can find communities where you know, the average income is a dollar a day or less, but you still have cultural capital, natural capital, and so forth, and the lives that people lead are quite rich. And you can find other communities where there might be $3, $4, $5 a day, but, you know, the underlying natural capital has been completely eroded away. The culture has been, you know, people have migration out of the community. The cultural context has been destroyed. And now people suddenly need a lot of money, right? Whereas before, you didn't necessarily have to be in the money economy. So I totally agree with that, right? And as business people, we have to understand that, right? That in co-creating any business, you have to understand the totality of that situation.
Okay, thank you, Stu and Hans. Okay, could you identify yourself first, please?
Yes, my name is Marc Dumo. I'm from Chagnon Foundation, a philanthropic foundation from Quebec. I was wondering about the Grameen model and importing this model in Canada or in Quebec. I was absolutely fascinated by the model itself, but I was wondering, was there any thinking done about a very particular aspect of the Canadian context for poverty? In this characteristic is the social support system for the poor. When you make money and you're poor, you lose your allowance, your monthly allowance of welfare, and that's it. Mm-hmm. You lose it totally. And this means that importing the model and make people starting business and all this, they'll have to make enough money to compensate what they lose with the welfare. And this is not, it's not a small amount of money. I mean, it is something that will, for example, slow down people when they say, okay, I'll go back to the workforce. The English is stupid. But, I mean, I will regain the job that I have and to make money, and they realize that they don't make, at the minimum wage level, they don't make money enough to compensate what they lose on the welfare. So when you come in with a model, a business model, it will have to generate quite a lot of money. Not as in Bangladesh, like you have absolutely nothing and then you start making money. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing. Okay. I think it's not the same thing in the United States. From what I know, I'm not an economist and I'm not in comparative economy, but I think that based on what I see, for example, from the Casey Foundation work in New York, the level of poverty is absolutely incredible compared to a place from Quebec or Canada, anywhere. The social system is totally different, social support system. And do you have any thinking about that, or did you find a way to apply this to...
It's a very good point that you raise. The welfare system in the United States is, I guess, similar to Canada. I think it's a pretty large extreme. If you make $1, you get kicked off the welfare system. Professor Yunus has an interesting comment on welfare, and he believes that the systems around the world that have welfare system need to be modified. There needs to be an incentive that if, instead of having people on welfare, they should have an incentive that if they make $1, the welfare system gives them an additional dollar. And at some point, if that continues, they will reach a point where their pride and their self-image will tell them they should continue earning money and should stop taking money from welfare. In the United States and our market, and in my brief conversations, we would have to do further study in Canada, but most of our borrowers are immigrants who have come to the country and are not part of the welfare system, so we're providing them with an access to capital that they could not have. Most of our borrowers are not on the welfare system, so it doesn't become an issue. About 10% of our borrowers are American citizens who are younger people who had no access to getting any opportunities, so this is a loan that's giving them the ability to start a business that they would not have had. They also had no other possibility of earning income through a job, and many of them live at home, so their cost of staying, housing, and their food and their other expenses is covered by other family members.
Okay, thank you. One last question, and then we'll have a bit of a break for some coffee.
Tia Kansara from the Kansara Hackney Firm, UK, one of two directors. I'd like to thank the panel very much for your insightful information and the various projects that you work on. We've just recently come back from Cuba, where we were asked to work with UNESCO on a self-help project. The huge problem that I see ahead of us, having also just come back from India, is the amount of people who will be moving to cities and forming larger slums. One of the situations in India, for example, is that they've estimated 40 million people moving from countryside into these cities over the next 40 years. That's four decades, and that's a lot of people in cities. What is it that you're looking at, for example, as your future involvement in slums? and that's open to all of you, in particular Amit Mittal as a technology consultant and also the two financial advisors.
Okay, thanks a lot. Amit, do you want to tackle that first?
So, you know, the urbanization creates both an opportunity, but as you said, challenges as well. I think the opportunity, certainly from a technology perspective, you know, so for example, when I was in India 4 weeks ago, let's go back to mobile telephony as an example. The deployment of technology in urban areas is often fundamentally less expensive than in rural areas. You aren't dealing with the same challenges of distance, of sparse infrastructure, of low return on investment, and those kind of things. You have a dense environment. In fact, that's the reason why cities exist, right? Because at scale, you can provide infrastructure at much, much lower cost. So from that perspective, you know, whether it is internet-based technologies, mobile technologies, that kind of thing, many of the fundamental barriers for access are mitigated when people move to an urban environment. But, of course, that's replaced by other challenges. You know, that's replaced by challenges on do people have, you know, the right environment, the basic right environment, what shift of their, how does their allocation of disposable income change? You know, when you move to a city, you know, you end up spending a vastly larger amount of money on housing, on food, on those kind of things, and much less on kind of the elective things that you might otherwise be able to do. So, you know, from my perspective, especially now and especially in the emerging markets, it's a very dynamic environment. It's a very dynamic kind of situation where on a technology-by-technology basis, things change on a yearly basis. And you kind of have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. I'm sorry, I don't have a global answer to that. But, you know, what we're finding is that it creates opportunity as well as different challenges.
Okay, Stu, and then Hans, and then we'll take a break.
I think you put your finger on perhaps the fundamental issue, you know, of, you know, the coming next decade or two. Yeah. And by my way of thinking, I mean, as I think about this transformation that I was describing, it has the potential, if we do it right, in other words, a set of emerging technologies that tend to be point of use, small scale, distributed, applicable at a community level. And that includes, you know, emerging communication technologies that don't require as much infrastructure to reach, you know, further out areas. So the way I look at it is we're facing the challenge and the opportunity of figuring out how do we create and grow opportunity, dynamic, sustainable economies in situ, where people currently live, to prevent the sort of mass migration that you're describing. That really is the fundamental challenge that we have, especially in a country like India, right? Mm-hmm. Where continued mass migration to the existing large cities is just simply unsustainable. And it can't work, right? Or in a country like China, where the central government will relocate people, and they are and will relocate 200 to 300 million rural people to cities in the next decade. Those aren't going to be to big megacities. Right? Those relocations will occur to the small cities in China, you know, to the 20, they call them towns, to the 20,000 small cities in China. So there's an enormous opportunity for us in these communities that are going to grow tremendously in the next decade or two to figure out how to incubate tomorrow's way of more sustainable way of living on an enterprise-based, using an enterprise-based approach, and that becomes the future. I mean, to me, that really is that's the monster opportunity and challenge that we face for the next decade or two.
Okay, thanks, Stu. And Hans?
I make it shortly, but I guess it's a question of creativity. It's a question of creative power. And if I look to India, and I'm teached 7 years, I was teached by Mother India to stay there, and to look to Mumbai and see Maharashtra, the main aspect is we have to find a new interface to the nature, because the most people come to Mumbai at the moment because the farming doesn't make the income anymore. You know, We have no water, we have no trees, we have no fundamental income anymore for the people. So what we have to do is finding a way of trading agriculture in a total new way. You know, Maharashtra and the place where he was when you went with the train from Mumbai up to Igatpuri or Nasik, it was 60 years ago a total rainforest. Now it's red stone. Nothing. So how we find altogether a completely new way with the modern technology of water, of mobile phones, of computing, then the people go back. This is one access and probably one of the most important in the world, how we can, the people doesn't want to live in the city. They have just not another opportunity. They love to go home, to the, especially India, your family-driven community, so everybody wants to go home. Secondly, mostly men coming first to the city to try to survive, and that can't go home because it was not successful. So on the social business aspect at the moment, it's like for the time if we go hunting, you know, we go out, we try to bring something home. Now they go into the big city. They get in a trap, that doesn't come out, they miss the family, they bring the family back. So this is the issues, and what we have to do is to get the young generation with the access, the directly access from the modern technology up to this problem to create a better interface to the nature and having more creative power on this issue.
Okay, and last word to Kevin for this session.
Just quickly, the urban setting is our sweet spot. Why? Peer-to-peer. Far more concentrated. One of the difficulties that we have in certain communities is that the women have to get in a cab to get to speak to some of the referrals, et cetera. The urban community is really where you have peer-to-peer opportunity. In addition, with respect to public service information, you can far more effectively get that communicated. So in our opinion, urban and peri-urban areas, one, have severe water problems, okay, but two, we can get the most efficient dissemination of information and sales. So the urban trend is, in my opinion, directly in line with the direct selling model that many of your new companies will be employing.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. Can we just thank everyone here again for I think that's just a tremendous start to our 2 days. And I think, Hans, at the end of your talk, you said, what kind of world is this? And I think we've all got to keep that in our heads as we go through the next session. So let's break for 15 minutes for some coffee, and then we'll pick up.